Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
One night in some DuPont bar, I had a couple too many free beers from a guy who thought Jay's accent was just delicious. And someone told me to smile. I was being a drag. I told him I was tired. I'd been sleeping in my car. He said, "You're never going to fix your situation if you don't put out some positive vibes." People like that are why I felt better walking around at night. I couldn't sleep anyway. My little Ford Aspire, the car my mom had bought me to replace my toasted Acura, forced me to sleep sitting up or in some origami-inspired knot in the back seat. It was too hot to sleep with the windows up, but the mosquitoes found a cracked window just as fast as they'd find a vein. I'd spend hours just walking around the city, waiting until the air was cool enough and I was exhausted enough to sleep.
That was writer Lauren Huff reading an excerpt from her debut essay collection, Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. Lauren is probably best known for a story she published in the Huff Post in 2018. The headline was, "I was a cable guy. I saw the worst of America." In the piece, she described the lowlights of her 10-year career fixing cable connections for irate customers. The story went viral, and it all led to this publication of Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. In her book, Lauren explores the various identities she's inhabited over the course of her life. Besides her career as a cable guy, Lauren also served in the U.S. Air Force and worked as a bouncer at a gay club. We caught up with her to talk about her remarkable life and her career roulette. So much of her unique journey kicks off from her childhood as a member of the Children of God cult, which actors Joaquin and River Phoenix also belonged to.
It really depended on where we were. My early years were pretty idyllic from my memory. We were living in campgrounds and traveling around in Argentina and Chile. And it was great. There were always lots of kids to play with. We were desperately poor, but you don't know that when everyone around you is poor too. Later on, when we rejoined, it wasn't fun at all. We spent most of our days either changing diapers and taking care of little kids and cleaning the house, or out on the street selling posters. You really can't get used to anything, and it's your life, but it makes it really hard to describe to someone else because of what they're used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You say that it's entirely possible that the way you speak, and by extension the way you write, developed in rebellion to family speak. Can you explain this to us?
One of the punishments they used against us, especially in the last years I was in, were if you spoke too loudly, if you were caught being foolish, telling a joke, and if you sighed when someone told you to do something. Basically, if you were a teenager, you could get put on silence restriction, which meant you weren't allowed to talk at all.
For how long?
It could be a day, it could be months.
Wow. What was the longest you had to...
I did 30 days was my longest sentence.
Wow. What was that like?
It was really frustrating. It was really frustrating. Most of the kids in the home knew... we knew some made-up version of American Sign Language that we would... Just the alphabet that we would use to talk to one another, but you couldn't get caught doing that. It was just easier to not get heard if you were talking with your hand. I don't have words for not being able to say words. I think it's definitely a reason I became so outspoken later on, is realizing I could speak, realizing that I could handle the consequences if I do speak, has been life-changing for me, and thankfully it happened early on.
Yeah. You left the family when you were 15, and a few years later, I think 3 years later, you joined the Air Force. This seems to me kind of like a psychological lateral move because you're leaving one oppressive culture for another. Why did you decide to join the Air Force?
Like you said, it's psychological lateral move is a really good way of describing that. It was in my cult-raised mind the logical next step. And most of it is I just wanted a way out of Amarillo, and I consumed the commercials that we all did of join the Air Force and see the world and get a college education and get a leg up.
Yeah. This was during the 90s when the don't ask, don't tell policy was in full force. As a gay woman, did you have to deal with homophobia?
Yes, definitely. And also, no. One of the great things about the military is it's such a wide diaspora of people who join. And most people my age were raised on MTV. We didn't have a problem with gay people. The problem came when all it really took was one person to have a problem with it. And I didn't really know what don't ask, don't tell meant when I joined. I don't think a lot of people did. We thought it was you don't walk into your commander's office and say you're gay, you're fine. But the problem with that one person is a lot of people were turned in by their exes. It was an easy way to hurt someone.
But that didn't happen to you. You weren't turned in by your ex, but you had a couple, well, one in particular, really horrific incident that happened to you. Can you know which one I'm referring to, I think?
Yeah, I'd been getting death threats for a little while. I didn't see them as death threats. I saw them as someone just being a jerk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then my car blew up. Someone torched it. So the problem with don't ask, don't tell is I hadn't told anyone about the threats because that would be an admission that I was gay. They would start, well, why are you being threatened for being gay if you're not gay? And it would have turned into a whole thing. And I was just, you know, trying to get by like anybody else. It was a terrifying time to be gay in the military. Once you realize that people had this power, that they could destroy your life if they knew your secret, you never really knew who to trust.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be really a really tough situation. So how did you end up leaving the military?
Well, I ended up doing really what they wanted. After the court-martial and the investigation, and now every airman on base knew I was gay because that was basically the point of the investigation, I'm pretty sure. I quit. I walked into my commander's office and handed him a note. There's a organization at the time, Service Members Legal Defense Network, that basically that's all they did was help queer service members in the military. They helped me write the letter, and I was thrown out probably about a month later. I was just notified, you have 48 hours to leave, and that was that.
Yeah. You say you don't like the word family, and who could blame you given your childhood, but you did end up finding a family when you became a bouncer at a DC nightclub. Can you tell us about that time in your life?
Yeah, I definitely have a knee-jerk reaction to the word family. There's a thing that happens in any of those jobs, I think, especially bar jobs, or I've found it to happen. We're all so raw and tired at the end of the night. Your walls kind of come down. They can't come down around the customers, so they have to come down somewhere, and they come down around your coworkers. Yeah, you develop these very close relationships. It's also healthy, I think, if you're wallowing in self-pity, which I think I definitely was. It's hard to feel sorry for yourself for, you know, having to eat boiled liver when you're working around these queer kids who no one ends up working at a bar because their life turned out perfect. But I started thinking of them as family. We do that in the queer community, I think, especially because a lot of people do lose their families coming out. So we develop sort of a pseudo family.
Mm-hmm. I think that your definition of depression is the best one I've ever come across. Can you share it with us?
If you can't imagine any sort of future, that's how we get a lot of hope from imagining positive outcomes, not trying to manifest them or something, but just knowing that maybe things will get better. If you can't envision that in any way, that is depression. That is the hopelessness that comes with it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I felt so many times and continue to feel occasionally, not as often as I used to, but yeah, it resonated with me when I read that because yeah, anytime I'm depressed, it makes total sense. When you can't imagine a future at all, what's the point of going on? You worked as a cable tech in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C. for a decade. What was that experience like?
Yeah, it's 10 years, so it's hard to pick one word. I think that's why I had such a hard time writing that essay. I was talking to guys I worked with at the time and people I knew, and just, why don't I remember 10 years?
Maybe because you didn't want to? Maybe because from the sounds of the essay, maybe because you didn't want to, because you were seeing like that, you were seeing the really ugly, dark side of humanity with all these irate customers who were ticked off.
I think so.
Yeah.
And yeah, at some point I just said, you know, all I remember is needing to pee. And that is how that essay started. I'm like, oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. Why couldn't I pee? Let's get into this.
Exactly. You actually had to make a service call to the former Vice President Dick Cheney's residence. Can you tell us how that went? Do you remember that, or have you managed to repress that
memory? I was kind of distracted, and I made a waterboarding comment to him. But
what was the waterboarding comment that you made to him?
Oh, his cable was going to be out for a while, and it wasn't him. It was his assistant or the agent. I don't know who the guy was, but
right.
The guy talking to me. It was sort of the, do you have any idea who that man is? And I was like, I mean, you can waterboard me if it feels like it, but it's still going to be.
Did Cheney react to that?
No, not at all. Yeah. if he did, I wasn't looking. I just walked out. I didn't want him to take me up on it.
Yeah. No, understandably right. Understandably so, yeah. You say that you'd spent so much time surviving that you'd forgotten to live. If you don't mind my asking, how have you addressed that? Because it seems to me, I get the sense, and maybe I'm wrong, that's another question, is you now have kind of learned to live again, haven't you?
I feel like I have. I think we're just tired. I mean, 10 years go by when you're waiting for the weekend to come. And that's all I had, is you had that Sunday evening where you're filled with dread because Monday morning's coming. So I quit. I sold everything, and I moved into a Winnebago and drove around, and I had kind of a 5-year plan to become a writer. And it's funny, I tried to not put any sort of happy ending to the essays or the books. I don't really believe life always turns out like that. And I guess I sort of added a happy ending because the book's doing pretty well.
Mm-hmm. The book's doing very well. Yeah. You capture so much of our dark world so well, and I was really impressed by how you basically boiled down human existence to 9 words. Do you know what those words are? Do you remember?
We work, we consume, we get sick, we die.
Exactly.
Those are the words.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. You really just boiled it down. Yeah, can you talk a bit, expand a bit about what those, you know, words mean to you?
I don't know if so many of us are just depressed as we've realized that's our life. We don't have a social safety net in this country. We don't value our personal lives. We value work, and there's got to be something more to that. And people seek it out in religion and in different ways, and you know, whatever works for you. I spent a really long time trying not to lay in bed at night thinking of the future of this being the same thing every day until Sunday night. I could watch a TV show while I folded laundry, and it was depressing as hell. So I quit.
Yeah, the line that really resonated with me was this in that portion of the book. Your book was, it's like every company bought the same self-help book on how to save money by skipping raises and get the same loyalty by turning your company into a cult. What are Sundays like? What are Sunday nights like for you now these days? They're better, I hope.
I have the freedom now to travel when I need to or when I want to. I've been driving around signing books at independent bookstores because I was just sitting there in my this rental house staring at my phone, and nothing felt real. I think a lot of us are having that problem right now, but nothing felt real. So I started driving around, going to bookstores and signing, and it's been a whole lot of fun. Yeah, there's something very cool about being in New York as a writer when that wasn't something that happened in real life to me as a kid. You know, I didn't know what a writer's life looked like, but I imagined they lived in New York and, I don't know, went to cool parties, but I got to walk around signing books, so.
I can see that when I follow you on Twitter. Yeah, that when you seem there does seem this joy just in the photos you show and the comments you offer when you've signed books. Yeah, so that is good news. So you have had so many different identities as an adult. Now you can add great writer to that. Are you able to embrace that identity?
No, not at all. But
why
I
not?
Am a writer.
Is it too soon?
I think so. I think I'm just having a hard time absorbing it all right now. I don't know that our brains are built to absorb. Mine certainly is not built to absorb a lot of this. My brother has been saving all the clips, and you know, he's the first person to know where I am on the bestseller list or if I'm on it. Yeah, he's been saving it all for me, so I also have to send him all my famous person retweeted me tweets. I mean, you don't want to be uncool about it on Twitter, but you definitely want to tell someone. So I get to tell my little brother. He's pretty impressed.
Yeah, he should be. A few minutes ago, you mentioned this idea that you had this 5-year plan to become a writer. So how do you feel that plan was, by my judgment, I would view that as a success. Do you view it as a success that you've made that happen?
I do. And I was down to the wire.
Yeah.
I'd moved to Austin to start going to community college, and I was working at a bar just in case I was going to run out of money pretty quick. But that cable guy essay blew up, and it's been a little surreal since. It's funny, when it blew up, I was still working at the bar, and people were coming in to meet me because I'd written an essay. I'm still talking to an agent or editor on the phone, and someone's trying to talk to me, and you know, someone else is puking on the patio, and I have to go take care of that. I'm sorry. I can talk about my future later. Yeah, it's been a surreal experience. I still haven't processed, I think, most of it. There was a certain time in my life where I just realized that my life wasn't going to be very fun or interesting. And it's not always fun. It's pretty stressful sometimes, but it's definitely interesting.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Thank you very much, Lauren Huff. It was really great talking to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lauren Huff is the author of the essay collection, Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. Find out more about Lauren at wpr.org/beta.
When you don't know anything about game development and you start a company and you think you're going to take on one of the biggest games in the world, things are probably not going to go well for you, unfortunately.
Journalist Jason Schreier joins us to talk about the current state of the video game industry. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.